Adventist World Radio. From broadcast to baptism. Powered by SID Media.
Pastor Mulupa, good afternoon to you, sir.
I must stage a protest this afternoon, Dan.
What is the protest?
Because I also want to be part of that worship song before I preach, so that I can be in the space.
Yeah. Beautiful
good
stuff,
man. A cousin as well. I love him.
Oh yeah, is that so? I didn't know that.
Yeah, definitely. He's
wow.
He's a great guy, man.
Okay. I know something I didn't know. Great stuff, indeed. Oh, fantastic guy.
Yeah.
Now, Mfundisi, we are continuing on to wonder where we left off yesterday. We're talking about the death, life, and the resurrection of the Christ. And of course, we've discussed the life of Christ pre and post his miraculous birth to a virgin. Today, we move on to discuss the death and the complex reality of that being a moment of great power. So, but before we get there, you're going to be coming to me with some kind of a response, I think, yesterday. What did we talk about? There's a quotation that you made, but yes. I do think that one listener as well was quite interested. I think it was Derek on what was that. Let's perhaps take it from that. Let's actually recap from that.
Sure. I actually got a call also from one of my dad's friends. He's a senior pastor.
Mm.
And he said two things to me. He said, firstly, he wanted to discuss what we're about to discuss now, the virginity of Mary, even post the birth of Christ. But secondly, then he said to me, hey, man, you got to slow down. I can't hear a word you say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, today I'm going to try and slow down and speak a bit, articulate myself a bit slowly.
Yeah.
And, hopefully we'll get more in.
That's true.
So, Desire of Ages, pages 42, 70, 72, 92, 94, 97. These are all the pages where Ellen White is—I don't want to use the word insinuating, but she is suggesting that Mary stayed a virgin even after she gave birth to Christ, and a virgin in inverted commas. I mean, biologically, it won't be. It won't be logical to say that she was a virgin even after giving birth to Christ. But for all intents and purposes, she did not take part in any or consummate her marriage.
Mm.
Let me rather put it that way. Afterwards, and Ellen White suggests that in the pages that I have mentioned now, she does not explicitly say that. And the conversation I had with the senior pastor yesterday was. For him to caution me to be clear on that part, to say this is a suggestion from Ellen White.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily clearly stated. And so he says to me that because a lot of theology outside, even outside of Adventism, does agree with that position.
Mm-hmm.
So it is generally a statement that is accepted, yet it is not explicit. And what makes it not to be explicit is that is the points that you raised yesterday, the point of the siblings, the point that the canon does not actually at any point say that Joseph has or is a widower. The canon does not explicitly state that Joseph is bringing kids from another marriage where maybe he's a divorcee or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
The canon, though, does say that Jesus was the firstborn of Mary, and that then suggests something else, because it could have just said Jesus is the child of Mary. But for the canon to then say is the firstborn, of course, we understand it from a prophetic validation to then say that the firstbornship was taken from Adam given to Christ, because he's the second Adam, but he becomes the firstborn, because even at resurrection and all of that, we'll deal with that a bit later tomorrow probably. But generally speaking, that then creates a challenge and therefore creates a debate. From an Adventist perspective, from an Adventist belief, we do believe that Mary stayed without consummating her marriage after the birth of Christ.
All right. So it's basically an assumption, really.
It is basically an assumption. It's a highly debated topic in theological circles.
All right. And then the siblings that he had, Jesus, were these older siblings?
Sure. Yes, they are perceived to be older siblings because they are being mentioned at the birth of Christ, or around the, at least the birth of Christ. So the perception is that these are older siblings.
I see. All right. But well, it's not today's discussions. We just wanted to clear the air in as far as the points that you were raising yesterday is concerned. I do think that we have a responsibility, those who are listening, to go into the scripture and dig up and see where we can find these things and make up your mind out there and come to a particular conclusion. Would hear also what you are out there are thinking. Now, Pastor, we've established that this great being who existed from eternity past, as you mentioned, decided to punctuate his eternal life with his time on earth, whose decision was it for Jesus to come. And now, who decided that it was his time to come and die? Who made that decision?
I'm loving the diction you are using. He punctuated his time. It's beautiful. So I have a theory. It's a personally held theory that decisions that are made by God are made by him because he has a broader view, spectrum of what is actually taking place. And so when that decision was made, it was made by God. And this is what brings me to that conclusion. There are two terms depicting time in the Greek language. It's kairos and chronos. Chronos is the time that we use on a daily basis that we can point to. When you said, no, I'm going to call you at 3:30, that is chronos. It is the time to show us where we are in our daily lives. But kairos is at the appointed time. So every time when the Bible says at the appointed time, it's referring to chronos. It is referring to a time that has been on God's mind for the specific event to take place. It's referring to a time when the plan has been put in or is going to be put in motion. It's referring to a time that has been blessed for that particular purpose. It's referring to that day when you eventually received that qualification on graduation. It's referring to that day when you eventually received that employment. It's referring to that day when you were giving birth to your first child or your second child or your third child. It's referring to that day when something beautiful and miraculous happened. It's also referring to that day when something tragic took place. It is an appointed time for something important to take place. And so those don't go willy-nilly. God plans for that, for the kairos time. And when he plans for the kairos time, it is always so that something great can take place in your life. And so to answer the question, it was God's plan that Christ comes at the time when he came. It was God's appointed time, kairos time, that Christ comes at the time when he came.
Okay, right. Now, excuse me for that. Why did it have to be a death sentence, though? I mean, as a righteous judge, did he have no power to cancel the crimes of humanity, as it were?
Man, you know,
that was a brutal death, by the way. Quite gruesome and graphic and a very unforgiving death, I must say.
I watched a documentary just 2 seconds ago. I watched a documentary where they were making that Passion of the Christ movie. And is it Mel Gibson who was doing it, who was acting?
Yeah, it was Mel Gibson. Yeah.
So he then explains in that documentary how many times he fell sick and was under evil attack in his life. At some point, the budget for that movie was taken away. There was so much negativity and pushback from creating that movie, just so that he could depict at least how they perceived what Christ went through. And so he says the devil did not want that movie to be shown anywhere, because it was magical. What happened was just something else. Now, here's the thing, to answer your question. Here's the thing about why Christ had to come and die. There are two things that take place at the beginning. Number one, God makes a promise that if you eat of this tree, you shall surely die. And the devil comes to refute or to contest that promise, that it is not so, you will not surely die. So that the promise that God has made that this will be the repercussion of sin, because the devil has made it a point of contest, then that it is important for Christ, when he comes, to die. Second point, Christ has created us in his image. So for us, when we are created in his image, and then that image is promised death, and then he takes up the visible physical image that he has created so that he can be with us physically. But maybe let me pause and say this. We don't look like the devil in any way. So I don't expect the devil to care whether we die or live. I expect him to care whether he's going to follow us, because we don't look like him. We're not created by him. All that he wants is the popularity. All that he wants is to be followed. All that he wants is to be seen. All that he wants is to take over from what he has not created. And so the one who has created, the one whom we look like, he takes the responsibility to come down and to be with us and to look like us. And then what he does is, when he is down here and he is facing the cross and everything is coming down to the tire hits the tarmac, he then allows himself to go through. He becomes vulnerable. And let me maybe pause here on the issue of vulnerability. Because if it was not for vulnerability, Christ would have not gone to the cross. If it was not for vulnerability, Christ would have never been arrested. If it was not for vulnerability, Christ wouldn't have been able to show the disciples the value of humility. If it was not for vulnerability, the church might not have been given letters and the gospels and everything else that followed. If it was not for vulnerability, Jesus needed to be vulnerable and allow the soldiers. After he says the seventh I am, John talks about Jesus saying the seven I ams. After he says the seventh I am, and these guys fall to the ground, he needed to be vulnerable and allow them to take him in. And he goes to the judgment hall, and he goes in front of Herod, he goes in front of Pilate, and all of that culminates towards showing that when God has appointed for this to take place. It shall take place for the benefit of his children, for the benefit of his people.
Now we are, I think about his death and with quite a bit of discussion around the death specifically. Takes me to, there's a lot of wind where you are. I'm not sure what's happening.
I'm sorry, let me try and find a less windy place.
Oh, okay.
I'm actually standing in the sun. But it's fine. Yeah.
All right. Now, that's all right. Now, it takes me back to the story of Lazarus when Christ had to, come and raise Lazarus. He made sure, as it were, we were told that he comes back 4 days. When we actually read across, these 4 days would definitely ensure that somebody was actually dead. He had not fainted. He had not collapsed or in a coma or anything like that. And then he then rocks up 4 days later to confirm that indeed Lazarus was dead. Now, with his life, he dies on a Friday, and we don't wait that extended time to ensure that he's dead. We simply just confirm that he was dead. Was he surely dead? Could have been in a coma, actually.
let me tell you a joke just before I answer that. So I heard the other day somebody said, why do you guys keep saying saved by the bell? I look at him, no, what are you talking about? Mm-mm. Says, no, this thing of saved by the bell, it's an ancient expression where what they used to do is when they bury you, they would tie you up to a string and tie that string above the grave and tie that string to a bell so that if you wake up in the grave, you can ring the bell. And then we will come and dig you up, because they had discovered that they were burying people who were not actually in fact dead. And so we're busy saying saved by the bell. We're talking about dead people.
You, I tell you.
Now, remember that Christ was pierced on his side. So even it, so and so, you'll also remember that it takes a maximum of about 2 hours for somebody to bleed out, a person who is not treated or blocked or anything, just if blood is flowing. Remember, if you are trying to if a person is trying to commit suicide and they cut their wrist, within the first 20 minutes, they will collapse. And then while the blood is pumping, before the next 2 hours is done, they will definitely be dead because they will bleed out. And so that's the first thing that we've got to think about when we think about Christ hanging on the cross, is that when they wanted to confirm that he is dead, they actually... because the prophecy says they will not break his bones, right? They will not break his bones to kill him. His bones will be intact. And so that they don't break his bones, they needed to check if he has already died. And so somebody came and put a spear on his side so that they can check if he has died. But I don't know if that person understood that he was actually bringing out the salvific power that was hanging on the cross, because we needed the blood to flow. Since there was no blood at any point, the lamb was supposed to be slain and blood must flow, because if you remember the sanctuary message, it is the blood that is sprinkled in an attempt to ask for forgiveness for the sins of the nation, for the sins of the people, for the sins of the individuals, for the sins of the pastors, for the sins of the priests, for the sins of anybody who has committed sin. This guy pierces the side of Christ, and blood and water flows out of Christ, so that the prophecy can be fulfilled. But that biologically tells us that there is no way that Christ was alive throughout that weekend. Mm. He was definitely not alive throughout that weekend. But let me also just push this one in. The fact that
before you push it in, I'm not sure, you're saying that there's no way he could have been alive. There's some wealthy guy they said, "Ah, this guy's dead." Of course, they are not medical practitioners. Somebody could have, been in a coma. But some wealthy guy came and says, "Listen, let me take this guy to my grave." And so they take him out of the cross, and some wealthy fellow with a lot of money who had an empty tomb hired this thing out to him. And this actually could have been the period where he was treated.
Oh.
Because remember, these guys thought he was dead.
Let me.
And he was taken out of the cross. Immediately on that Friday evening, he was, in fact, Friday afternoon, was taken out and assumed to have been taken to a tomb for a burial. And we don't have a record of the detail of what actually happened. He may have been in a coma.
Sure. Man, Josephus, there's a guy called Josephus.
The historian.
Yes. Great. So Josephus talks about something very interesting. He talks about the fact that when a Jewish child is born, he's given two certificates.
Right.
One is for his birth and the other is for his grave. Mm-hmm. It's actually an address it's a certificate that shows where this person is going to be buried. And so when Jesus is born, he's not born in that environment where he's going to receive both those certificates. So even if he gets a birth certificate after, he does not get a grave certificate for the reasons that you have just alluded to, because he was also a son of a carpenter who couldn't afford. But that's just beside the point. Then when Jesus dies, Joseph knows this. Joseph of Arimathea, rich guy, you're talking about.
The wealthy guy.
Yes, Nicodemus also knows this, because remember that they had become the friends of Jesus. Ellen White says they had Nicodemusly become the friends of Jesus. Nicodemus and Joseph had Nicodemusly become the friend of Jesus. So both of them, when they take Jesus off the cross, they actually seek for permission from Pilate. Pilate, who is the one who was making sure that these guys have died. Remember, the process was that they will hang them on the cross. Mm-hmm. If they don't die by themselves, they will then break their feet, so that the process of dying is like this. So when they are hanging on the cross, they can't actually, it's meant to suffocate them. It's meant to make them not to breathe. Mm-hmm. So, but the problem is, because there are nails that are driven into your legs, your feet, then you are able to support yourself and go up so that you can catch your breath and not suffocate. So the reason why they had to break their feet is so that you can't go up, you can't support yourself and go up and catch your breath. So they force you to suffocate. And so the reason why Pilate is satisfied that Jesus is in fact dead is because there came a physician, or whoever who was designated to check for life. Mm-hmm. And that person checked for life. And that person said, no, this guy is dead. There's no need to break his feet or his legs. And then they needed to make double sure that he is dead. And so they pierced him. Now, a person who is alive, when you pierce him, it is only blood that comes out. Mm-hmm. When a person dies, there's a process that is called rigor mortis that shows how long the person has died. Mm-hmm. Part of that process is water will separate from blood.
Okay.
So when he's piercing Christ, And the blood comes out, but it is separate from the water. That tells you that Jesus had not yet died. I mean, had not died just at that point when they were piercing him. Mm-hmm. He had already died an hour or more before they actually pierced him. So when you look at the empirical evidence that is presented in the text, you then are able to see that there is no way Joseph and Nicodemus could have done anything to resuscitate Christ, because after he had died, they drained his blood.
Now, tell me, thank you for that. We literally are 4.5 minutes to the end of our conversation. Sure. And I think it's the detail is important. That's why I'm actually getting into the detail. Now, this moment of death, which I believe was quite humiliating and honestly quite embarrassing, I must say, because these guys, they came, I mean, he came when his people were waiting for the Lion of Judah, a powerful guy, a mighty God who was prophesied to come and save the people. And so as he came and lived his life, I mean, we've got examples where they really and honestly thought that our mighty guy is here. He's going to just deal with this Roman Empire once and for all. I mean, we got a man on our side. And yet he comes and dies in a very humiliating and quite embarrassing way. How can that be viewed as a moment of power?
Oh, remember Kings chapter 1, where Solomon becomes the king. That what you are explaining is exactly what they expected. They expected a situation whereby the brother of Solomon, who had just been placed as the new king by Joab and the other pastors, was representing the Roman Empire, and Solomon was representing Christ as the Lion of Judah. The theology was thought to be in that way, that when Christ shall come, it will be like when Solomon was given the rulership by David, as David was about to die, and he says to Nathan, go and take my mule and go into and walk Solomon through the city so that everyone can see and put him on my throne. Now, they expected that to happen, which is also why Jesus, just a few days before, rides into Jerusalem on a mule. Come on, somebody, on a mule, signifying a few things. Now, when you ride on a horse as a king, when it's any other colored horse, it is a horse that is going to war. When it's a white horse, it's a horse that's coming from war, representing victory. But when you are riding on a mule, you are saying there is peace in the land. You are declaring peace in the land. There's no war. That you are not going to war. You are saying that even if you were to wage war, we are declaring peace, because if we went to war with you, we would crush you. So Christ makes that statement when he's riding into Jerusalem. These guys, they had expected that Christ will take the throne, just like you're saying, that as a lion of the tribe of Judah and all of that. Unfortunately, they misread Isaiah when he explains that this is for the purpose of taking away the sin of the world. They totally misread the prophecy when the prophecy talks about what the payment that must be made for sin. So even when Jesus is kneeling in Gethsemane, he then gets a visit from Moses and what's this guy's name? Enoch. And they talk to him about what he needs to do. It is because when he is there in Gethsemane, he needed to follow through with the plan. As difficult as the plan was, he needed to follow through with the plan. So the fact that he could have evaded the whole thing, a songwriter says, he could have called 10,000 angels to save us, but he died alone for you and me. The plan needed a follow through. I don't know if there's a husband and a father listening to me this afternoon. When you make a promise, follow through with that plan. Follow through, because those who are watching you are expecting it to happen. And that may be their only way or their only hope for salvation. When they see you as the high priest, the priest of the home, they can be able to relate to Christ even better. To say, this Christ is a person who follows through on his promises.
Well, Pastor, it's been a fantastic one. We're going to be ending it right there, a screeching end, because it's a very important conversation. And I think that it's one that has caused a lot of discussion over centuries, and very important that we actually dig up in detail of that. We have not even gone into the implications of his death, but unfortunately, the time is completely gone. But we'll catch it up tomorrow again, same time and same place.
Definitely. I'm happy. I slowed down quite a bit today.
Thank you, Pastor. Good one. We connect tomorrow.
God bless. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Adventist World Radio. From broadcast to baptism. Powered by SID Media.